It's hard enough to lose somebody. It was just so brutal, and she was all by herself. I think that was the worst part.
My daughter, she is bleeding to death.
She was just white. I saw blood.
I'm running towards the house, and I had a guy grab me and says, "You can't go up there." I said, "Oh, I'm going up there. That's my child."
You can't get it out of your head. You just want to go home and hug your children.
She had a watch, hair clips thrown through the room. So it looks like at that point that there probably had been a struggle. She had been fighting back.
This was personal. Somebody knew Megan.
There were footprints in Megan's blood.
We were looking for the shoes that had the footprint.
Did you recognize that footprint?
Yeah, let me see.
They were looking at everyone that she had contact with.
Did you kill Megan?
No, I was in shock.
It hit me so hard. Instant panic.
I still get chills.
It just can't be.
People have secrets.
People have a lot of secrets.
The family that lived in this cozy house on this quiet street never came back after the awful thing that happened here.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying to think of.
It was April 10th, 2008, Portsmouth, Virginia. Police Sergeant Robert McDaniel was right nearby when the All Points Bulletin went out to law enforcement.
The call comes out, and it's literally one block away from where I'm standing.
Did the address ring a bell?
It did and it didn't.
All he knew was that someone had been killed inside that house.
So you go there, and what do you discover?
I went in to clear the house out of anybody inside the house to make sure the scene stayed as pristine as possible for him. And when I looked down, I realized then that it was Megan.
Megan Landowski, the teenage victim, was someone he knew. He knew her whole family. It was her stepfather, Chris, who found Megan's body as he came in from work.
She was just white, just laying there as peaceful as she could be. Then I looked again, then I noticed I saw blood.
My daughter, looks like she's been sexually assaulted and she's bleeding to death.
Wait a minute. Slow down. What's wrong with her?
My daughter's bleeding, blood all over the thing. Looks like her throat was slit.
She was a tiny 16-year-old girl who cared about people and loved to dance. He couldn't comprehend what had just happened to her.
Could you tell how she had been killed?
I recognized what I saw, but I wasn't processing what I saw. Does that make sense?
When I found Chris, he was going into a state of shock, and he had this distant look in his eyes.
I still had the phone in my hand, and he was the one trying to bring me out of the trance that I was in. He pointed at his eyes and said, "You know me, look at me."
Chris pulled himself together and called his wife Angie at her office. Her coworkers drove her home.
So we get there, and they've got the house taped off, and I'm running towards the house. And I had a guy grab me and says, "You can't go up there." I said, "Oh, I'm going up there. That's my child. That's my house." And I'm like, "I want to make sure it's her. I want to see her. I want to make sure that it's her." And Chris grabbed me and said, "It's her."
So you were trying to protect her to not have to see what you saw.
Right.
With good reason. Megan had been stabbed over and over. There was blood everywhere. She never stood a chance. It was a terrible sight, even for veteran law enforcement.
You can't get it out of your head. And it's something, you know, you want to go home and hug you.
It's okay. I know how hard it is, given what you saw.
Okay. You just want to go home and hug your children.
Investigators put aside their personal feelings and started to decipher the story told by the evidence. They learned fairly quickly that after school, Megan dropped in on a neighbor.
So they have a conversation.
For a few minutes.
A short one.
A short conversation.
Does she say if anyone's coming, she's expecting a visitor or anything?
She's talking about school, normal stuff, how's she feeling, that kind of stuff. And then she tells her that I'm going to go back and make macaroni and cheese for my brother when he gets home. Yeah.
Suzanne Sequeira and her husband, Carl, are crime scene investigators. They arrived at the house and quickly started to identify clues, like a small leaf found on a bedroom floor. That told them how the killer might have gotten inside.
Finding this leaf was kind of a surprise. When we went outside, there was this big bush right under the parents' window that actually had this type of leaf to it.
The bedroom window was unlocked, the screen pushed up. They surmised the killer climbed over the bush and through the window and forced Megan upstairs where she was bound with tape and sexually assaulted.
Her underwear and her skirt were on the floor. There was also, she had a watch, hair clips, like, and it was thrown through the room. So it looks like at that point that there probably had been a struggle. She had been fighting back. We believed that somehow she gets up and gets down into the kitchen.
It was there that the killer finished his attack. With a knife from the kitchen, he stabbed Megan about 40 times. Seven of those wounds were inflicted after she was dead.
Just the mere volume of these stab wounds, there's a whole lot of anger involved in that. That's not what you would typically find on a random attack.
This was personal. This, somebody knew Megan.
At the base of the sink were bloody shoe prints. The investigators noted how the prints led from the kitchen to the front door.
We could see them leading from the body coming out the door.
Based on the fact there was blood on the storm door coming out from the inside, so we know that he came out the front door.
Was Megan's blood found on the doorknob to the front door?
It was a mix. There was a little bit of hers and the suspect's.
Police believe the killer was still carrying a second knife taken from the kitchen.
It was from the butcher block, and the missing knife?
It was the missing knife.
You believe the killer had dumped the murder weapon as he ran down the street?
As he was running down the street, we believe he just tossed it down the sewer as he was running away.
While police launched a murder investigation, the news spread quickly through the community. Heather Manusis was a friend from Megan's dance group.
My dance teacher called a meeting. They wanted everyone there who knew her. Most of the other students in the room were a lot younger, so I think she was trying to be very, very sensitive to that. I just remember her saying that Megan had died, and it was at that point that I asked, you know, did she get into an accident? And they told us, we don't really have any details right now.
But it wouldn't be long before details of the killing did come out. Brittany Hoffler was a friend from school.
It's hard enough, you know, to lose somebody. Sorry. You know, but it was just so, you know, brutal. And she was all by herself. I think that was the worst part.
Megan's lonely, painful death was something everyone took to heart. Friends, family, police. They remembered a girl brimming with life. Now, finding her killer would require determination, imagination, and help from everyone her life had touched.
I didn't know if it was somebody who had targeted her specifically.
She didn't have any enemies that you knew of?
Not that I knew of. Nobody.
A sudden realization hits Megan's stepfather, one early, obvious suspect.
I was in the back of the police car, and I called the agent in NCIS, and I told her, I said, the bastard killed her.
The savagery of Megan Landowski's killing prompted a far-reaching response by law enforcement.
Is this all hands on deck?
Everybody was there. A lot of our resources were used on that case.
As investigators began talking to Megan's friends and family, they were hearing pretty much the same thing.
Megan had really close friends, and then she had, basically she was friends with everybody.
More than that, they heard that Megan lived to make people happy. But her parents say she was happiest when she danced.
She was really good at it, and she was so small, and she was so tiny, and she just would float across that stage, and she was beautiful, just beautiful.
I remember her parents coming in with this wild child. You can kind of tell when they first walk in what they're like, and she just had tons of energy.
Her after-school dance coach, Kelly Derrick, says her favorite kind of dance was also the most rigorous.
As soon as she started ballet, it looked good on her. It looked right on her.
She had really, really great ballet feet. We used to call them like banana feet. She had perfect arches.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Is that what you call ballerinas with good feet?
That's ballet what we feet? Called them, yeah.
The girl with the banana feet also had a sense of empathy beyond her years.
I met her at my audition for the Kelly's Dance Explosion dance team. I was really, really nervous. I had no friends there. I didn't know any of the teachers. And Megan was the first person to approach me and kind of walk me through the audition.
Investigators learned that kids and adults just liked being around her.
She always had her hands, you know, hugging or jumping on somebody, or she was just always in your face, always. If I would walk down the hallway, she was always, "What are you doing, Miss Kelly? What are you doing? Where are you going? Do you need any help?"
One of the jokes that she started kind of around our dance school, I'm not sure if I should say this or not.
Sure, go ahead.
She would say, "My balls hurt," like the balls of her feet. So that became like a saying that we joked around the dance school for many, many years because of her.
Megan and her family lived right across the Elizabeth River from the Naval Station in Norfolk, Virginia. Mom Angie had a job at a construction company. Her husband Chris worked at the Naval Hospital.
So Megan was your stepdaughter, but really like your daughter.
Absolutely. We just hit it off as just, she was my daughter. I mean, we joked and carry on.
She was the protective older sister. She was the comedian of the family. She was the entertainer.
And the boss.
And the boss.
And as it turns out, a pretty chatty boss.
There was a joke in the family that said, "Megan, 5 minutes. Can you go 5 minutes without talking?" And she goes, "Okay, time me." So I'm like, okay. So we did it one day. She couldn't. She couldn't do it.
From what I've been told, she cared a lot about her grades.
Yes.
So everything, it sounds like everything with Megan was sort of, was she like a perfectionist?
Or I wouldn't say she was a perfectionist. She just wanted to please everyone.
Her freshman year, she got into a high school with a special arts program. She found herself surrounded by talented dancers, singers, classical musicians. She was putting in long hours, commuting on the bus.
Would you two sit together on the bus?
Yeah, all the time.
What did you talk about?
Anything and everything. Just friends, people that she had met.
Would you talk about boys on the bus?
Yes. Yeah, we would hear it here and there, for sure.
She did talk quite a few times about certain guys, but it wasn't anything serious. It was all, you know, like little crushes here and there.
Was there a type of guy that she liked? Whether it was like an athlete or...
Not that I know of. I mean, like I said, she just kind of loved everybody in their own way. It didn't matter where you came from, what you looked like, what your story was. She was going to be your friend.
And that's how it was, until it seemed that Megan's smile started to disappear. And she just wasn't herself.
A little over halfway through the year, her grades started slipping a little bit, and she kind of changed out of nowhere. And she was kind of just rebelling a little bit, was getting into trouble a little bit at school.
Would she confide in you at all about what was going on?
Yes, typically she would, but it was a complete switch that kind of changed.
Something was seriously wrong, and a few months later, Megan was killed.
I just didn't know what to think. I didn't know if it was somebody who had targeted her specifically or if it was just a random. To me, it sounded like someone who would have been pretty angry with her. And I couldn't think of who that would be.
She didn't have any enemies that you knew of?
Not that I knew of. Nobody.
But her parents knew something the friends didn't. In his grief and panic, his home now a murder scene, her stepfather made one more phone call. This one to investigators with the Navy.
I was in the back of the police car, and I called the agent in NCIS, and I told her, I said, the bastard killed her.
A secret was about to come out. A secret that Megan's family believed had everything to do with her murder.
I said, tell me what happened. Tell me what's going on.
Megan shares her explosive secret, first with her parents, then with the police.
This has got to be excruciating for a 15-year-old to come in and talk to a total stranger, even though you're there to help her, to expose this potential secret.
Yeah.
I was hurt. I was mad.
It was betrayal, plain and simple.
Megan Lindowski's parents were blind with grief. But even with all the chaos that followed her murder, they felt certain about who did it. It had to do with something that happened months earlier, when Megan's grades took a dive, along with her spirit.
She was very emotional, and we finally told her, said, okay, your grades are our only concern right now. We got to get them up. Whatever we have to do, let's do it.
Megan's parents thought the school was the problem, so they switched her to a different high school closer to home for her sophomore year. It was that fall when even Heather noticed the change.
I hadn't seen her in probably about a month and a half, so I was excited to see her, and she did not seem like herself. She just seemed, I don't know, not her bubbly personality. It was almost like she didn't even want to say hello.
Like a light had gone out?
Kind of, yeah.
Her parents also wondered about some of the kids she was hanging out with. They suspected one of them was involved with drugs.
We noticed that she came home a couple of times and all she wanted to do was sleep, which threw up red flags with us.
They had her take a drug test. It was positive for marijuana.
We confronted her about it, you know, and she finally admitted it, that she had tried it. And so I'm like, okay, well, let's try not to do that anymore. So, and she agreed.
But Megan continued to have problems.
I asked her what's going on, and she told me nothing. And I'm like, no, this ain't nothing.
So this is more than just pot at this point. You feel like your gut's telling you something's up,
right,
mm-hmm, with Megan. Mm-hmm.
She actually ended up leaving dance. Her parents were kind of having her take a break for a little bit, hoping that she would bring her grades back up and that then she'd be able to come back.
Did you try to call her or text her to talk about it?
No, I just figured I didn't want to intrude on her. Maybe she just needed some space.
At home, the problems were getting worse. Chris says he threatened to do something he had never done before.
I told her, I said, if you don't tell me right here now, you're going to be severely punished. And I told her, I said, I'm going to blister your butt until you tell me the truth.
She told Chris something that changed everything. Something that convinced him the grades, the attitude, the pot weren't the problem. They were symptoms of something far more serious.
Then she tells me that Rob Hickey had been touching her.
Robert Hickey, a married father of four daughters, a Navy health specialist, a close friend of the family.
He picked up for officer, and he was on his way to make captain.
Their families hung out together, birthday parties, summer cookouts, grown-ups, and kids.
This is your close friend.
This is my best friend, and I trusted him more than I would trust just about anybody else.
Chris immediately called Megan's mother and told her what he had just heard.
And I'm like, are you serious? Are you sure? And she got on the phone with me, and I told her, I said, tell me what happened. Tell me what's going on. And then she told me, and I told her, I said, are you sure? Because this is someone's life you're going to ruin. And she goes, Mom, I am absolutely 100% sure.
How did you feel on the phone when you were told this news?
I was hurt. I was mad. I was sad for his family because of what they're about to go through. And I was more hurt for Chris because that was Chris's best friend.
It was betrayal, plain and simple. But you don't expect it from a guy that you trust with your life.
Is it that feeling like you've got this news? Do you want to just like run over there and, you know, I don't want to say it, but, yeah. You know.
Oh, trust me.
Oh, yeah.
Do some harm?
Absolutely.
100%.
Megan's parents decided she needed to talk to the police. And that's when she first met Sergeant Robert McDaniel.
I was a detective in the Special Victims Unit.
That's right. The officer who would go on to investigate Megan's murder is the officer who first heard Megan's story about Robert Hickey.
So this has got to be excruciating for a 15-year-old to come in and talk to a total stranger, even though you're there to help her, to expose this potential secret.
Yeah.
He remembers she started slowly, fearfully.
And then told her, I said, I've heard just about anything that you're going to say. You're not going to embarrass me.
She said it all began with Hickey paying special attention to her when she was 14.
He started talking about how pretty she was and that kind of stuff. And then he kissed her one time. And that was closer to when she turned 15. He'd always catch her by herself. And that's generally what we call, like, it's like a grooming to get her used to being around without her parents around. And then she was kind of impressed that somebody older was paying attention to her that wasn't her parents or her family.
Megan told him that after she turned 15, the relationship became sexual.
How old is he at this time?
He's in his 30s.
After Megan told her story, Sergeant McDaniel came out to speak with Chris.
He said all we can charge him with is a misdemeanor, and he could get maybe 12 months in jail for it at the most.
And I looked at him like, are you kidding me? He said, unfortunately not.
That's because in Virginia, while sex between an adult and a child 14 and under is a felony, sexual contact with a 15-year-old is only a misdemeanor.
So as a father, as a mother, you must be just infuriated by that.
I was furious. And I was like, where do we go from here?
Sergeant McDaniel had an idea. Hickey was in the Navy. And the military takes a harsher approach to adults who engage in sexual contact with minors.
The age of consent in the military under the Uniform Code of Military Justice is 16.
Special Agent Dana Schutt handled crimes against children for NCIS, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service.
The first thing we did was bring in Megan to talk to her and get a sworn statement from her.
The agent found her to be credible, believable, that this young woman was telling the truth?
Yes, the agent found her to be very credible.
Now Robert Hickey was facing possible military charges that could put him in prison for years. They brought him in for questioning.
He said nothing. He invoked his right to silence.
With that, the Navy continued its investigation toward a possible court-martial.
Do you feel that Megan has some relief?
Megan's stress level dropped tremendously. Her grades are starting to come back up. She was actually looking forward to trying to help put Robert Hickey away.
Then came that April afternoon when Megan's short life came to a terrible end. And suddenly, Robert Hickey was the number one suspect in her murder.
Those are powerful words from a teenage girl. I fear he could kill me.
She asked me, she says, do you think that he'll come back and kill me?
Robert Hickey in police custody.
He drops to the ground and starts crying.
And the heat is on.
Did you kill Megan?
No.
You have no idea he would hurt her.
Not a clue, sir. Not a loving clue.
Megan Landowski was dead, and police had a prime suspect, Robert Hickey. Months earlier, Megan told investigators she had sexual contact with Hickey when she was just 15. It was chilling now for Sergeant McDaniel to recall what Megan had said when they'd met.
She was worried that she was going to get killed by him because he had a lot to lose, and she was coming forward and telling on him.
Those are powerful words from a teenage girl. I fear he could kill me.
She asked me, she says, do you think that he'll come back and kill me? And at the time I told her no. I said, that generally doesn't happen in these cases.
But Megan's family said she wasn't reassured.
She was scared. That's a heavy burden for a 16-year-old.
Absolutely.
Very heavy.
And every car that came down the street, she would call Angie and said, hey, I think I saw his truck. And Angie said, no, don't worry about it. It's not him. He knows better. He'll get in more trouble if he comes by our house. But she, in the back of her mind, it was always there that he was going to come after her.
Her family and police told Megan not to worry. But now it seemed so obvious to them. Hickey had plenty to gain from her death. It meant the end of the investigation into those sexual allegations.
So Robert Hickey's case kind of vanishes, right?
His case vanishes because he has a right to confront his accuser. So he can no longer do that because she's dead.
There's only one person we thought it could be. Just one. There's only one person that didn't want her to talk, and that was Robert Hickey.
Chris also told investigators at the scene he had another reason to suspect his former friend.
He said one of the footprints looks just like the shoes that he wears when we go to the gym.
And that scene had looked personal to investigators, like the killer was someone who was angry with Megan. They went right from her house to find Robert Hickey.
Nobody was home. He wasn't responding to phone calls or knocks on the door.
Bad sign?
That was a bad sign. Meaning? For us that he was running. We staked out where his house for a while. We were there for a couple hours. And then Robert Hickey came up in the family van with his wife and his kids. We're taking him at gunpoint at this point because we have a severe and brutal murder that occurred. We get him out of the van. We handcuff Robert Hickey. He was in a state of panic, and his family's in the van. And I walked up and I told him, I said, Megan Landowski's been murdered, and we want to know where you were today.
Wow.
So
what's his response?
He drops to the ground and starts crying. So we took him into custody, we put him in a car, and we brought him back. And we sat him in an interrogation room.
And then they watched for a bit, letting him stew and pray. He was clearly upset and visibly nervous as investigators walked in.
Why are you worried about your family?
They're scared.
Okay.
My daughters were crying and they're little.
How old are your kids?
1, 4, 10, and almost 13.
Hickey seemed shaken, but not surprised to find himself in the hot seat.
Do you understand why I'm talking to you today?
The police officer told me somebody killed Megan.
Yes.
That's what he told me, and that's all I... And because of an investigation that was done prior, he said that they had to consider me a suspect.
I don't know the background between you and Megan. Did you and Megan have a sexual relationship with your boyfriend and girlfriend one time?
I can't really say anything about that because it had something to do with another investigation.
When was the last time that you were at her house?
Sometime in December.
Sometime in December, you don't know.
I don't remember when, no.
So there's no reason why your fingerprints or anything like that would be in your house?
No.
Be in her house?
Not unless they've been there since last December. No.
No, they don't last that long.
No.
On the day Megan was murdered, Hickey said he was busy. He and his wife had an appointment with a marriage counselor.
I had to be home by 3 because our counseling session started at 4.
And before that, he said he'd been at work.
And you didn't leave work at all today?
Not at all. I can tell you from the time I got up to the time that you saw me, I was with someone every second of the entire day, except for the time I went to the bathroom. Now, I've got computer records. I've got people that I saw. I mean, it would never even occur to me to have to have to tell everybody where I was every second of every day.
You have a computer there.
Yes, I do.
Is there anything on that computer that's going to relate to Megan?
No.
Okay.
Nothing.
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 Is there any pornography or anything on the computer that's going to jam you up?
There's no pornography on the computer.
And there's nothing on that computer. Because you said better to tell me now than you.
Up until January, there was pornography on the computer. I was addicted to pornography. I got rid of everything off there.
Detectives wanted to get their hands on Hickey's sneakers to see if they matched the footprints left at the scene.
They're in the garage.
They're in the garage?
Yep. Right inside the door.
And then, detectives asked Hickey flat out.
Did you go to Megan's house today?
No, I did not.
Do you know who went to Megan's house?
No, I didn't. That was the absolute furthest thing from my mind until they told me what was going on. I have no clue, sir. I wish that I did, but I don't.
Did you kill Megan?
No.
Are you angry at her?
No, not at all.
Out of all the stuff that's going on, you're not angry with her?
No. What I did to myself, not anybody else.
And you have no idea who would hurt her?
Not a clue, sir. Not a loving clue.
Hickey insisted he was not their man.
I really don't know what to tell you. I was in shock, and I'm still in shock, and I don't know what to think.
But was he telling them the truth? The investigation was just getting started.
We asked initially where his gym shoes were. The shoes were supposed to be in the garage. When we got into the garage, there were no shoes.
New questions about Robert Hickey's story. The plot thickens.
You thought maybe he hired somebody?
Yes. Even if it wasn't him, he had someone do it.
Did you believe that there was a possibility that Robert Hickey had paid someone to do this?
Yes, that was absolutely a possibility.
There was plenty of suspicion on Robert Hickey. While police talked to him at the station, investigators searched his house for those gym shoes.
We were looking for the shoes that had the footprint.
Those bloody shoe prints found at the crime scene had a distinctive pattern. But at Hickey's house...
We asked initially where his gym shoes were. His wife took us around a lot of the places to show us where Robert Hickey's stuff was, specifically in the house. And the shoes were supposed to be in the garage. When we got into the garage, there were no shoes.
He easily could have disposed of the shoes?
And that was what we were worried about, is that he threw the shoes away, or got rid of them, or left them at the base.
It only notched up investigators' suspicions. Back in the interrogation room, detectives noticed Hickey's nervousness, but began to think his grief over Megan's murder seemed genuine.
I feel so bad for her mom and dad.
Yeah, they're pretty upset about it.
I can't imagine we get about it, my kids.
Well, it looks like something probably didn't mean to happen the way it did, and it just things got out of hand. You know, stuff sometimes gets out of hand. You know?
Yeah, but it's still no excuse for somebody killing her.
He's acting more distraught.
So is he almost acting like a loved one?
Yes.
I know you have to do what you have to do, and I'm not angry at you, I'm not angry at anybody.
Here we are accusing him of possibly murdering Megan, and he isn't lawyering up. He's giving us a pass to search his house. He's giving us information, telling us what time he left work, telling us where he had been.
Police didn't have enough to hold Hickey, but they did ask for one thing during the interview.
He willingly gave up a DNA sample.
And he willingly gave a DNA sample.
Which is a big deal.
It is.
Given that you believe the killer had left his DNA behind.
Yes.
Hickey's sample was rushed to a lab, and the testing was fast-tracked against the killer's DNA found at the scene. Police also had to check his alibi.
And you didn't leave work at all today?
Not at all.
Okay.
We eventually were able to, through his command, determine he was at work that day.
Oh, he had never left?
He had never left.
Then, the results from that DNA test came back. Investigators were floored.
He was your prime suspect.
He was.
And there's no match.
There's no DNA match.
What's that moment like?
It's frustrating, because what you think you have, you don't.
A solid alibi and a negative DNA result. Investigators believed Hickey had the motive to kill Megan, but there was absolutely no proof he did it.
And I'm like, are you 100% sure?
You still believe he killed her?
At that point, I still believe he killed her.
Yeah, okay. We still thought.
So even with the DNA?
Yeah. And then we thought he had something to do with it.
You thought maybe he hired somebody?
Yes. Even if it wasn't him, he had someone do it.
Did you believe that there was a possibility that Robert Hickey had paid someone to do this?
Yes, that was absolutely a possibility and something we looked into. We pulled financial records to determine, was there a large amount of money that was passed to someone? And that came up to a dead end.
Again, no evidence. But one more possibility, thought investigators. Someone else they believed might have motive to kill Megan, Hickey's wife.
She had a lot to lose. Her husband, his retirement, the benefits. They had four kids, lifestyle that they were accustomed to living. There was a lot for her to lose at the same time.
So she could not be crossed off the list either?
No.
Investigators spoke to her, and it didn't take long to determine she was not involved in the murder.
Overall physical ability and the fact that she had the four kids all the time, there was a lot of different things that we looked at that just kind of eliminated her.
Did she have a solid alibi?
Yes.
Neither Robert Hickey nor his wife had anything to do with Megan's death. Hickey's attorney told Dateline his client denies any sexual contact with Megan and says being suspected of her murder ruined Hickey's life at the time. Still, the investigations didn't look good to the Navy. He was given an other-than-honorable discharge and denied his pension. As for the homicide detectives, they were back at square one.
Are you stumped?
We all were. The two lead investigators at the time thought they really had the case solved. And then there's no DNA match, so they had to start all over again.
Now it's come down to, okay, we have to find her killer, and we need to find her killer as quickly as possible, because with every passing day, you know, that makes an arrest even more unlikely.
Or put someone else in jeopardy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Investigators were going back to the beginning, a closer look at the crime scene and the people in Megan's life. Who would have wanted this young girl dead?
There's a killer out there.
Right. And we had no idea. No idea. Who in the world could do this, and are they going to do it again?
That trail of bloody shoe prints is about to lead investigators down a whole new path.
One of the neighbor's kids had a pair in the right shoe range that we were looking for.
I knew this kid, and he never came up on my radar.
Word was spreading throughout Portsmouth, Virginia, that the prime suspect in Megan Landowski's case wasn't involved in her murder. Megan's friend Heather read about it in the newspaper.
At the time, they were saying, you know, we knew that they had DNA and that his DNA did not match. So we were shocked by that, but at the same time, if the DNA doesn't match, you know.
Where do you go from there? You know, there's a killer out there.
Right, and we had no idea. No idea. I think your mind just goes through who in the world could do this, and if they'll do it in the middle of the day to someone so young, are they going to do it again?
Detectives promised Megan's family they would only call if they had an arrest. Weeks passed, and that call didn't come. Reporter Mike Mather covered the story and says there was a growing sense of frustration.
I mean, part of you hopes it is something that sews up quickly. Part of you hopes that it's something that is just obvious enough for the police to solve it right away and not have this community worry that it's somebody who has come in, done this horrific murder, and is now free in the community.
There was fear, but also profound sadness, even for those who barely knew Megan. In the wake of her murder, a local church dedicated a tree in her honor.
This is Megan's tree right here.
This has been Megan's tree and always will be Megan's tree.
It was a place where those who had loved Megan could mourn, and the grief was shared by Sergeant McDaniel and Agent Shutt. Most investigators meet their victims in death. These two had tried to help her in life, and now they were united in the effort to find her killer.
Having known her and met her, we knew that we wanted to do this for her. We needed to find out who had hurt her so terribly.
You had a war room of sorts with this case, and you met often.
Yes. I essentially moved into Portsmouth Police Department. I was there every day, and we were all collaborating. You know, we had a list of a to-do list, if you will, and it was every day, day in and day out. It consumed all of us.
Another look at the house gave them greater insight. According to crime scene investigators Suzanne and Carl Sequeira, the attack appeared unsophisticated. The killer had tried to clean up in a hurry.
We saw some water in the sink. So there's a good chance that he or she has washed their hands at some point and possibly gotten the victim's blood off their hands.
The killer had also cut themselves, and the killer's blood was mixed with Megan's. There was no shortage of physical evidence left behind.
You've got your killer in DNA form.
Yeah.
Forensically.
You just don't know who he is.
We had his touch DNA, his blood DNA, his semen. We had his fingerprints. So forensically, we had, you know, what we needed. It fell on the detectives at that point in time. It was a matter of them just really doing old-fashioned detective work.
NCIS asked a psychologist to create a profile of Megan's killer. The profiler believed Megan's murderer was most likely a schoolmate or a member of the victim's social groups, which made sense because they now knew whoever left those footprints had been wearing Nike Air Force Ones.
Air Force One was the hot shoe at the moment. Believe me, we looked at a lot of Air Force One tennis shoes in different places, especially young kids. They really sought after tennis shoe.
But there were a lot of young people in Megan's life, not only at school, but in her neighborhood too. And it was on Megan's block that Sergeant McDaniel got his next lead.
One of the neighbor's kids had a pair of Air Force Ones in the right shoe range that we were looking for. They were very close to Megan and her brother at the time.
That neighborhood kid turned out to be the younger brother of one of Megan's close friends. Megan's parents were skeptical that he could be involved.
I knew this kid, and he was harmless. He was kind of the younger of the group, but he always, like, followed them around. He never came up on my radar, and they were like, well, the pattern's similar.
It turned out that boy had been given the shoes by a couple of male relatives shortly after Megan's murder. Those relatives were older than the profile, but they had brushes with the law.
The family members were known to be into criminal activity, and both of them fled the state right after it happened.
So you thought maybe they were trying to dispose of the shoes by giving them to this boy?
Right.
The two relatives were picked up by U.S. Marshals on outstanding warrants and were about to be brought back to Virginia. What, if anything, did they know about Megan's murder?
I made a mistake, boy, and I'm sorry, boy.
Someone else in the interrogation room.
Now, explain to me how you know that girl was taped.
Because that's what I heard.
That ain't what you heard.
Yes,
you need to tell me a little bit more. I think you know some firsthand information you're not giving.
No, I don't, sir. I swear.
Everything he was doing would make you believe that he was the one that killed her.
Investigation into who murdered Megan Landowski, the sweet 16-year-old who loved to dance, had shifted to her circle of friends and acquaintances. A few weeks in, investigators had a good lead. They were trying to connect that sneaker print found at the crime scene to neighbors of Megan's.
You took these two people seriously to have marshals come in.
We took everybody that we thought would potentially could have done this. We took everybody serious.
The men in question had left town not long after the murder.
So you brought them back. Did you interrogate them?
When we brought them in and talked to them, we found that they didn't know Megan.
And didn't know anything about her murder. Their fingerprints, their DNA, didn't match what was left at the scene. But investigators had plenty of other people to talk to. starting with a high school full of potential suspects.
So the day that she was killed, we went back and pulled all the video and tried to track Megan all the way through the school just to see if there was any type of confrontation, if there was a guy.
The videos didn't point to anyone suspicious. Still, they interviewed student after student, looking for someone who had a problem with Megan, but no luck.
Everybody talked nice about Megan, but when you have no leads, you want to find the one person or several people who aren't saying nice things about Megan.
Popular at school, Megan even stayed friendly with kids from the Arts Magnet program she'd attended as a freshman.
She was very inclusive. She really would hang around with anybody.
Anybody. Yeah. She did not care what she looked like, what you liked, if you liked different music than her. She didn't care.
Megan's friendliness made it harder for investigators. In fact, she was so beloved, her remembrance tree was getting plenty of visitors. And that got detectives thinking. Maybe one of them was more than just a visitor.
We were working with NCIS, and they came up with this, hey, we got this idea. Maybe the killer will come to the tree, maybe he'll say something, or whoever it is.
So right next to the tree, NCIS technicians placed a hidden camera in a memorial stone.
We had a container that was off here, that was off to the side. We would run the recordings back to the container and change the VHS tapes out.
Every day?
Every single day.
Did the investigators ever find anything? Did you find anything?
No, we saw plenty of her friends, people who cared about her, people that we didn't know who they were, and they would come up, people from out of town, but no killer.
So a creative tactic, but yet another...
Dead end. It ended in a dead end.
Investigators had what they hoped would be another source of leads, Megan's own words. She'd kept a diary.
We went through the journals that Megan kept. We were looking for boyfriends or anything that might give us a clue.
Or anyone maybe she was angry at or that was angry at her.
For a teenage girl, she wasn't down and negative. She was very upbeat.
Do you remember her having a boyfriend at all during that time?
No, not anything super serious that I would consider saying that this guy was somebody that she dated as a boyfriend.
Was there anyone that she was interested in?
Not really. There was a few guys that she talked to that were in, there was one that was in the band, and then there was another one that played baseball.
But the guy who caught investigators' attention was named Donald. Her parents thought he was a bad influence, but Megan had befriended him. Detectives didn't have to look hard for Donald. He was in jail after being arrested for driving without a license. Right off the bat, they found his words and demeanor strange.
I made a mistake, boy, and I'm sorry, boy.
What was he talking about? He told the detective he and Megan had briefly dated.
They used to go out with her behind her parents' back.
Behind her parents' back?
Because her parents didn't wear going out with me because I was 2 years older than her.
Between tears, he swore he had only fond memories of Megan.
And I don't know why somebody would do this to her because she always made everybody laugh and smile after school. I mean, I loved her to death. Like, she was my little angel.
Loved her to death? He also told the detective it was Megan who broke up with him. They wondered, was he torn up enough to murder her?
What do you need to tell me about Megan's death? Son, listen to me.
What do you need to tell me? I didn't do it.
The detective asked him what he knew about the crime.
They grabbed her, took her inside, tied her up with some round tape or some round wrap or something like that.
And then the detective came at him.
Now explain to me how you know that girl was taped.
Because that's what I heard.
That ain't what you heard.
Yes,
you need to tell me a little bit more. I think you know some firsthand information you're not giving.
No, I don't, sir. I swear.
You're digging yourself in a hole you're not going to get out of. You get one chance at this today. One chance at this.
Can we start all over?
Let's start all over.
He swore he was just repeating gruesome gossip.
Who's telling you those stories?
Everybody at the school.
And as he fell apart before them,
I didn't have nothing to do with this girl's death, I swear to you.
His grief, to them, looked more like guilt.
I didn't have nothing to do with it, honest to God, Lord. And honest to God, sir, I don't want this on my chest right now. Because
everything that he said, the way he was acting, everything he was doing would make you believe that he was the one that killed her. getting DNA samples volunteered by everybody that we talk to.
Another DNA test and another sharp turn in the case.
We completely changed direction in our investigation.
Keep your soul at peace unless you tell me what's going on.
I don't know nothing.
Huh?
I don't know.
That's not going to work.
Detectives thought the young man they were talking to just might be the killer they were looking for. He clearly had very strong feelings for Megan.
Hey, tell the truth. And if you're part of it, you're going to burn for it.
I swear on everything, I love this girl to death.
Things got out of hand and you need to tell me.
He insisted he cared for Megan. He'd never harm her.
I didn't do nothing wrong. I wanted that. I didn't do nothing.
He offered up his alibi.
Did you work that day? Were you at work that day?
I was cutting grass with Zach.
Investigators wondered, was he their man? One way to find out, get a swab of his DNA.
And rub on both sides inside your cheek.
And then they sent him back to the jail and waited for the test results. Meantime, investigators still had their long to-do list.
Who are we going to interview? Where are we going to go? What evidence needs to be sent to the lab?
As detectives dove deep into Megan's young life, friends, neighbors, even strangers in the community seemed eager to help. Anything to narrow the field of suspects.
We're getting DNA samples volunteered by everybody that we talk to. Which is pretty amazing because we collected a hefty number of DNA samples from different people.
More than 80 people volunteered samples, even Megan's stepdad, Chris. But not one matched up with the murderers, and that included Megan's friend, Donald. Another letdown.
We were all hard on ourselves because we hadn't found the killer yet.
We were meeting every single day for months.
Every day?
Every day.
Are you holding press conferences as the months are ticking by to generate leads?
Initially, they did. They held a few of them, but we got to where we just didn't have any leads.
So investigators asked themselves, what else could their forensic evidence tell them? They heard about a DNA test that could trace a person's geographic ancestry.
At the time, it was relatively new DNA, and so NCIS had done some research into it. We didn't know what race that we were looking for, which helps generally so you narrow down your field.
The team sent the killer's DNA to a lab in Florida.
What did you find?
We found that 72% sub-Saharan African was the makeup of the killer. This person would self-identify as African American. So we completely changed direction in our investigation.
Investigators looked through their records for anyone they might have missed and found a notation in a file. Megan took martial arts classes.
The one that was running the studio at the time, it's an African-American-owned business.
The team asked the studio's owners to provide DNA swabs.
They all voluntarily came in and gave DNA samples?
None of those samples got a hit. Then the detectives scanned through Megan's other extracurriculars. She'd also spent time at a teen center on base. Someone there matched their profile.
There was a counselor there that was African American, and we talked to him.
He seemed more like everybody's friend.
Megan's parents knew the counselor and told detectives Megan considered him a trusted friend.
She looked at him as a big brother.
It never went anywhere from that. Did you start to wonder about him, given how close they were?
You grasp for straws. You don't have anybody pinpointed, then everybody's a suspect.
Most everyone they talked to so far had been helpful, but this guy?
How did he act?
He didn't trust the police, didn't want to talk to the police.
Not very cooperative?
Not very cooperative.
Still, investigators requested that the counselor, like dozens of others, provide a DNA sample. His response, unlike the others.
He said that he was too busy, and then he never came in to give it.
Did he start moving higher up on the list?
Yes, he became a person of interest.
Now the detectives had a lot more questions for the counselor. They officially asked him down to the station.
He was actually a no-show for his police interview?
Yes.
So what did that tell you?
It makes him look guilty.
But looking guilty and being guilty are two different things.
It's still not definitive.
It wouldn't be the last time in this vexing case. Investigators would have to get creative.
One by one, all the people who were the most obvious suspects or the most obvious potential suspects had been ruled out. There was definitely some fear in that community.
I wanted to do something to get somebody talking.
A memorial walk for Megan is about to bring investigators one step closer to the killer.
Did you believe her killer was hiding in plain sight?
We did.
Investigators had a new person of interest in Megan Landowski's murder, her counselor from the teen center on base.
He ended up becoming a suspect because of the way he acted.
Detectives said the counselor didn't seem eager to talk and never provided a DNA sample.
Did he eventually give it, or did you have to get it through another way?
No, they had to get it through another way.
We went to covert measures. We got a surreptitious DNA sample by swabbing the door handle on the driver's side of his vehicle while it was at the teen center.
Is that considered part of his property, or is it because it's on the outside?
It's what? On the outside.
Oh, so that's fair game, anything
fair
on
game.
The outside.
Yes.
And so the counselor was none the wiser as his DNA was compared against the killer's.
Was it a match?
No.
To detectives, it felt like deja vu.
What's everyone thinking
again,
at this point?
Deflated.
Deflated, but not done. They were still thinking about Megan's friend Donald and his strong emotional attachment to her.
All right, Donald, I need your attention for a minute, okay?
DNA had ruled him out as the killer, but maybe he knew something.
As sure as I'm sitting here, Donald, I believe you know who killed her.
No, sir.
As sure as I'm sitting here, Donald, I will tell you that you haven't been completely honest with me since day one.
Well, who was in there with you? Who's ever been in that house with you?
Nobody. When I
Somebody's
was there,
been there with you before.
No, sir, I swear to God.
He again told the investigators he knew nothing.
I'm not going to lie to you. If I knew who did it, you'd be the first one I'd call, sir.
And again, they thought he acted odd. He said he was too ill to talk.
Can we please just, like, hurry it up a little, man? Because I'm serious. Like, I feel okay. Like I need to go to
all
the
right.
Hospital.
Look,
I'm serious.
Like, let me tell you something, Donald.
Feel my saying? Forehead, sir.
I'm not going to feel your forehead. I'm not a doctor and I ain't your mama, so I don't feel your forehead.
Despite the drama, investigators had no evidence connecting Donald to the crime. He didn't do it. He didn't know who did.
He says, I really liked her. And he was very forthcoming after a while.
He tells Dateline he was traumatized by his lengthy interrogations and is truly sad about the loss of his friend. 5 months into the investigation, still no call to the family to report an arrest. After dozens of interviews, DNA tests, and tips, every lead had dried up.
It exhausted a lot of investigative skills, a lot of time, and every direction we turned was always a disappointment.
A new kind of fear gripped Portsmouth as the case went unsolved. Reporter Mike Mather remembered how folks worried this killer might never be caught.
One by one, all the people who were the most obvious suspects or the most obvious potential suspects had been ruled out. And that also means that they were ruling nobody else in. There was definitely some fear in that community.
Megan's parents lived in a nightmarish limbo.
You never lived in that house again?
No.
After that? Too painful?
I could still see her after she was gone.
That image of your daughter must just haunt you, seeing her like that.
Absolutely.
We started a new school year and everything, and it was still, nobody knew.
Did you start to get really worried that this not be solved?
Oh, yeah. And then you start to kind of accept maybe this is a really random thing. We all just kind of started to not really know what to make of it at that point.
The police aren't telling the public
anything.
Really anything.
Yeah. Yeah, there wasn't really much as far as updates or what was happening.
Did you have any fear that this would turn into a cold case, that that they wouldn't be able to catch Megan's killer?
We did have a fear that it was going cold, but the detectives told us they're going to turn over every stone that they have to get this case solved.
The investigators we spoke to, they had such a passion for this case, for solving this case. They said they were not going to let this go. Did you feel that?
Yes.
I felt it, yeah.
As the investigators tried to keep the case from stalling out, Megan's friends yearned for an arrest.
Did you feel like there was a chance that Megan's murder may never be solved as the months went by?
I guess I thought maybe there was a chance, but a very small one. I know that the police were working very hard, and I didn't think that it was something that they were just going to let go.
You had faith that they would solve the case.
Mm-hmm.
And then Megan's dance teacher, Kelly Derrick, came up with an idea, something she thought might help the police.
I wanted to do something for the community to raise, you know, questions, to get somebody talking, to get anything out of anybody.
On a Saturday in late September, friends and family gathered for a walk in Megan's honor.
We had a huge turnout. It was a beautiful day.
We told the community, you know, to come out and is to remember Megan.
You couldn't ask for better friends.
Your daughter was loved.
Very much so.
Investigators were there too, just in case someone had a tip.
Did you believe at this point that her killer was hiding in plain sight?
We did.
This time, in this lengthy and often trying investigation, creative thinking worked. Just days later, the phone rang at the police station. A new lead.
The phone call was from a concerned citizen that said, "Hey, I just heard something that might be of interest to you."
And was it ever?
The bus driver said there was one kid that took a liking to her. And I said, "Well, who is this kid?"
Enter a friend of Megan's.
They like hung out after school.
And a bubblegum mystery. Megan's memorial walk did the trick when it drummed up a promising new lead. A concerned citizen suggested detectives talk to Megan's bus driver, the one from her freshman year. So Sergeant McDaniel caught up with the driver outside Megan's old high school.
In Churchland High School, I walked up to her and I said, "Hey, can I talk to you about Megan?" Well, we had already interviewed 12 kids on that bus. And they all said, "Yeah, we knew Megan. She rode the bus. She was a good girl."
But the driver said detectives may have missed someone. She shared a story McDaniel had never heard before.
The bus driver said there was one kid on the bus that took a liking to her. And she kept telling him, "Hey, that's not the girl for you. I'm not trying to tell you what to do with your life. But you're showing interest in her and she's not showing interest back in you."
So the bus driver is giving this kid
saying, "Hey,
love advice," kind of harmless teenage stuff?
Yeah.
The bus driver worried it would end in heartache for the boy.
And I said, "Well, who is this kid? I've talked to all the ones that you pick up." And she said his name was Robert Barnes. We didn't know who Robert Barnes was at the time. We had never heard his name.
But Megan's parents remembered him. He lived nearby.
Robert Barnes would come over and catch the bus with Megan when they were both going to Churchland High School.
They were part of that same exclusive arts program. Megan danced and Robert played the violin. Around the school, he was considered an exceptional violinist. There was even talk of him going to Juilliard.
He played violin at a Governor's School of Music. He was on a roll. He was a kid that was going to make good. The success story.
And their worlds would collide when she was dancing, he was playing.
Right. I mean, he liked music. She liked music, too. That's how they kind of clicked together.
He'd practice on the bus with us on the way home. He was really, really good. He was a nice guy. He was normal. He blended in and he made good grades, did great in orchestra, was, you know, very committed to his craft of the violin.
Megan's friend Brittany remembers teasing Robert about his crush.
There was always that time where it was just me and him kind of on the bus, and I was like, I think you like Megan. And he, you know, of course tried to play it off at first and was like, no way. And he finally admitted it and was like, yeah, but just don't say anything.
Did he say what it was he liked about her?
Nothing super specific. It was just that he just liked hanging, you know, being around her, and she was funny and she was smart.
Would they ever study together?
Yeah, I know of a few times that they like hung out after school, or, you know, he'd get off at her stop and just walk home from there.
The detective went to Churchland High School to have a chat with Robert Barnes.
So I said, you knew Megan? He said, yeah. I said, can you sit down and talk to me? We sat down and we talked. He laughed. He kind of smiled about things. Didn't do anything out of the way. But the whole time I had this funny feeling about him, and it just was weird kind of feeling.
What was weird about it?
He just, for some reason, the smile on his face told me that's not the real person I was dealing with.
Hmm. And it was a facade.
It was all a facade. So I talked to him.
But it doesn't make him a killer.
No. I mean, he could have been hiding that he stole something from the 7-Eleven. I don't know.
Or he's a teenager being interviewed by a detective.
Right.
Robert seemed to fit that geographic ancestry profile. And the detective realized he could be the kid they'd been looking for. A friend of Megan's. A young person who might own a pair of Air Force One sneakers. McDaniel asked him to provide a DNA swab.
He said, well, I can't do it right now, but let me talk to my mom and see what she says.
Which is fair.
Which is,
I mean, if you're a high school kid.
Yeah, I really didn't expect him to say anything other than that.
The next morning, something unexpected. Sergeant McDaniel got a call from Robert.
And it's from his home phone number. And he says, hey, can you meet me at the school? I think I remembered something. You asked if I would remember anything, call you.
He said he had new information.
And I got the school resource officer and said, hey, this kid Robert Barnes said he might have something for me. He remembers about Megan. Can you go get him out of class and I'll talk to him?
At first, the meeting was a waste of time. His new information wasn't new at all.
He starts giving me some story about, hey, you know, I just thought it was kind of weird. She said she was afraid of somebody. All that was in the news. So he's repeating stuff that he heard in the news. I said, by the way, did you ask your mom about a DNA sample? He said, no, but I think it'll be okay. He's chewing on a piece of bubble gum.
Robert offered to give the detective his gum.
So you're like, I'll take what I can get.
I knew that the bubble gum was just as good as the swab, if not better. So we send the DNA, the bubble gum off to the lab with the other samples. It was about 2-3 weeks later, the lead investigator comes up. He says, hey, man, the lab tech needs you to call her now. It's 9:00 at night. And I was like, what is the lab tech doing in a DNA lab? And he goes, she needs to talk to you right now.
Robert's DNA test result was in, and it was about to crack the case wide open, but not in a way anyone suspected.
And she said, we got a problem.
That's a head snapper, right? This is a big moment here.
So I'm standing there with the lead investigator, and I said, we got to talk to this kid again.
And talk they did. Robert Barnes tells a chilling story about the day of Megan's murder.
The guys were sitting right there. Come here, kid. And then he pointed the gun at the both of us.
By now, police had tested the DNA of dozens of potential suspects. So far, not one hit. Then, Sergeant McDaniel got word he needed to talk to the technician about the results for 17-year-old Robert Barnes.
So I called her on the phone, and she goes, did you get it from a guy or from a girl? And I said, I got it from a guy.
He told the technician how Robert had given him his bubble gum.
She said, did you see him actually touch it or spit it out of his mouth? Or I said, no, he put it in a wrapper and he put it in the glove the way that I sent it. And she said, well, we got a problem because the DNA's coming back to a girl.
That's not male DNA. That's a head snapper.
And I just sat there and I said, well, he could have switched it because I had to turn my head.
If Robert Barnes had tried to pull a fast one, it didn't work. It only made the detective more suspicious.
This is a big moment here.
So I'm standing there with the lead investigator, and I said, we got to talk to this kid again.
With permission from Robert's mother, Sergeant McDaniel picked Robert up from school and drove him to the police station.
The funny thing is, when he was walking out of the car, I offered to open the door for him. He says, no, I got it. But then he pulled his hand up into his sleeve because he was worried that we were going to get fingerprints from him. So
this is a red flag for you.
Red flags all the way.
At the station, with Robert Barnes' mother in the room, Sergeant McDaniel told them the DNA on the gum belonged to a female. Suddenly, like a switch had been flipped, Robert began to talk.
You feel like close the door.
Sure.
And Robert Barnes looked at me and he said, this occurred on April 10th, right?
April 10th, the day Megan was killed.
It was what, Thursday, right?
The day that it happened?
Yeah.
He said, we got out of school at 12 o'clock. And we stopped.
Why did you stop?
His mom wanted to talk to him.
Let me speak to him out the door. I just want to speak to him out the door.
He was there voluntarily. We let him leave, go talk to his mom for a minute so that they could make a decision whether she wanted this conversation to go any further. They walked out, they sat in the car, they talked, and then they came back in.
And that's when Robert Barnes admitted he was in Megan's house on the day of her murder.
I go over Thursday. She says, no matter what, just come over.
He starts laying out the story about how he went to the house. Megan had invited him over. He had seen her at Valentine's Day prior to that. And then he came over because they had planned this out.
I knock on the door for like 5 minutes straight. No answer. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, the side window might be open. Okay, I go look the window up and I go in.
He climbs into the window and he's calling Megan's name.
She goes, I'm up here. Come here. She hesitantly said, come here though.
And here's where his story took a bizarre twist. He told the detective he walked into a crime in progress. Another man was already in the house.
I go in her room and the guy is just sitting right there. Come here, kid. He just had the gun, you know, sitting like this.
He claimed the man was on the bed, wearing a mask and holding Megan at gunpoint. Suddenly, the man started barking orders at him.
He goes, rough her up. And I'm like, well, what am I to do? He was like, I don't know, grab her by the throat. So he's just having me do all this sorts of stuff to her.
Like what?
Just basically, you know, just grab her roughly in the throat and the shoulders. He told me to tie her mouth up with the tape. But when I did it, she like bit it. So I couldn't, do it. And then he put the gun up to her head and said, don't move.
Robert said the man demanded he have sex with Megan.
And I attempted. We did that for like 5 minutes. And then that failed.
And even though they were being held at gunpoint, Robert said Megan tried to fight back.
And then that's when I'm like, Megan, just stop, you know, and just stop. Just do what you said.
According to Robert, the man told them to go downstairs.
He got really, really, really angry. Took her downstairs. I took her downstairs. And then he pointed the gun at the both of us. We were both just standing there.
And the masked man grabbed the knife and started stabbing Megan.
Stabbed in the neck a few times. And I think he stabbed in the back a few times. Like, at the time, I'm just, you know, like, I just didn't want to watch it. After I seen the neck part.
And the masked man, when he was done, made him hold his finger out. And he stuck his finger, cut his finger open, and put blood in the blood with Megan's.
And then he let, like, some of my blood drip out. And then he was like, if you tell anyone, I swear to God, I'll kill you and your family.
He ended his twisted tale by explaining how the masked man ordered him to leave.
I want for you to take your shirt off, because when he stabbed it, the blood just splattered everywhere. Mm-hmm. He said, take your shirt off and run. Ditch the knife in the gutter down the street.
Okay.
And after all that, that was it. I just did exactly what he said, and I just ran it home.
Are you buying any of this?
No. He's going through all the motions, and I'm watching his face, and you can see, like, he's proud of what he's talking about, but he's trying to play it off like he's just repeating what happened.
The teenager's elaborate story appeared made up to fit the mountain of evidence.
Did you recognize that footprint?
Yeah, let me see, because it might be from my Nikes. It kind of looks like mine from the kitchen area. Yeah, I think that's me going out the door.
When asked to describe the masked man, the detective thought Robert's answer was convenient, to say the least.
Just put a mask on me. He gave a description of me standing there in front of him because I was asking him how tall he was, what did he weigh. He even told me that the guy's eyes were blue.
White male, blue eyes.
Yeah.
White mask.
After interviewing Robert for more than 5 hours with his mother listening, the detective had heard enough.
Robert, I'm going to tell you something straight up,
okay? You see the crime scene, buddy?
Yeah, I see it.
All right. Mom, there's no other way to put this. Everything ties you to this place.
Yeah, I know.
Nothing ties anybody else. There's no footprints. There's no other DNA in the house. Everything ties you to this. Okay, 100%. All right? So I don't know any other way to put it, but you need to convince me that this other guy existed because I don't see anything. It leads me to another guy.
Now, Robert's mother jumped in.
Hold on for a minute. Is he under arrest? That's all I want to know. Is he under arrest right now?
Well, I mean,
is he under arrest? That's all I want to know.
I'm just asking him.
Hold on for a minute. Don't say nothing else.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt you. Robert, I'm going to take the funk out. I'm the lead investigator in this case, okay? Mm-hmm. Just going to let you know that you are under arrest for murder of Megan Lewandowski.
Okay.
Ma'am, that answers your question.
Finally, an arrest in the case that had stumped detectives for months. But would it lead to a conviction?
I mean, it just looked like they must have gotten this wrong. The police must have added one and one and gotten five.
Instant panic. It hit me so hard. I mean, you just feel so betrayed. I don't even have words to describe it.
A town stunned at the news.
This split the community right down the middle.
Could this talented teenager really be the killer?
Never heard a bad word about him, never. Accomplished so much and had such a good report card all across the board. Academic, social, everything. It just can't be.
The lead detective had made a deal with Megan's mom. He would only call once there was an arrest. 6 months after her daughter's murder, he called.
And I put him on speakerphone so Chris could hear it. And he's like, his name is Robert Barnes. I'm like, I know exactly who it is.
It must be just the strangest thing to hear.
It was. It was just like, why? Why her? Why him?
Word of Robert Barnes's arrest spread quickly.
My now husband went to high school with me. He said somebody got arrested for Megan's murder, and it's Robert Barnes.
What is going through your mind? This is the kid that you rode the bus with. Who had a crush on her, who was the violinist.
Yes. Instant panic. It hit me so hard. I mean, you just feel so betrayed. You feel so just, I mean, I don't even have words to describe it.
What was that moment like for you after such hard work and so many dead ends?
It was surreal. Even talking about it right now, I still get chills. Like, it was one of those moments that, you know, we've done our job.
But not everyone believed law enforcement had done its job correctly. Reporter Mike Mather remembers how some people in Portsmouth reacted when the news first broke.
I recall very early on that, you know, here we go again. Portsmouth has a white victim and they've charged a black kid.
This split the community on a racial line, I think, right down the middle, fair to say. And that line stayed there the entirety of the case.
Robert's defense attorney, Robert Moorcock, says the teen was an outstanding student, had no criminal record. How could he be the killer?
Never heard a bad word about him. Never. And we talked to a lot of people.
And a jury might have a hard time convicting someone who looks like Robert Barnes, who's that young.
That talented. Accomplished so much and had such a good report card all across the board. Academic, social, everything. And so that helped steal the pro-Barnes defense in the community. It just can't be. You know, it's a rush to judgment.
Sergeant McDaniel knew this was no rush to judgment. The case against Robert Barnes was strong and getting stronger. Detectives had discovered the honor roll student, the violin virtuoso, had another side, an evil one.
Do you think he had planned this attack out for a while?
Yes, I do. I think he had planned it out long enough, probably since Valentine's Day to the time it happened.
He was convinced of that because of what police found on Robert's computer.
He was very much into a fantasy world, breaking into houses and committing rape. He had put out questions on a chat room about if somebody said that they just killed somebody, what would you say to them?
Investigators began to wonder if Robert Barnes just might be a serial killer in the making.
He had put his picture, photoshopped his picture into a news report of an elderly woman that had been raped during a burglary of her house.
Robert Barnes put his own photo in a real news article.
In a real news article.
The more Megan's parents learned about Robert Barnes, the more horrified they became. It was all so cold and calculated.
After he did this to her, he went to orchestra practice that night. That night.
He cut his finger. He asked his mom, do you have any Band-Aids?
Wrapped his hand up because there are students there that remember his hand being wrapped. Wow. And his hand was wrapped and he went to orchestra practice.
After his arrest, detectives were finally able to test his DNA.
We got it within 24 hours.
Oh,
yes.
And was it a match?
It was a match.
That must have felt pretty darn good to get that DNA sample as a match.
For the whole group, it was a relief.
Given the mountain of evidence, Robert's attorney was ready to make a deal. And the prosecutor was receptive.
I don't think he wanted to further inflame the community. I think he wanted to end the case. He wanted to be tough, but he wanted to be fair.
So they worked out a plea. Robert Barnes pleaded guilty to first-degree murder, attempted rape, aggravated sexual battery, abduction, and statutory burglary. In return, he was sentenced to 42 years in prison. Megan's parents were relieved there would be no trial.
I didn't want to hear all the graphic details about what happened to her. I mean, I know what happened to her. I see it, you know, but I didn't want the world to know that.
And because of Virginia's violent sexual predator law, Megan's parents were told by the prosecutor it's unlikely Robert Barnes will ever be a free man.
When he's up for release, he has to take a test as a sexual predator, psych test.
You kind of feel like he won't pass and he won't get out.
Right.
On the day of Robert's sentencing, Megan's mom finally got a chance to confront him.
I love her. I miss her so much. I don't understand why. I don't understand why. She never did anything to hurt anybody.
I wanted him to feel my pain. I wanted him to know the person that he killed.
Losing Megan crushed my world. I want she was to graduate this year from my school. And I will never see that. I will never see her get married or hold her children. I can't go see her.
You caused all this pain that you see, and I wanted him to feel that.
Solving Megan's murder still feels bittersweet for the man who met the teen in a time of need and told her not to worry.
Does anything still haunt you about this case?
There's still guilt about what happened to Megan. I can't take that away. I'll never change that because it's a promise that I made that I didn't break the promise, but I still feel responsible.
For Megan's family and friends, with her killer behind bars, there's finally some peace.
You can at least start to heal a little bit from it and just move on and know that you don't have to constantly look over your shoulder.
Instead of focusing on how she died, they remember how she lived, joyful, loving, and forever dancing.
She definitely taught me how to be a better friend. And she's just, you know, just remember her light and her fun that she brought to the world.
I miss you. Wish you were here.
She was just very, very giving. I mean, even from the second I met her. I just wish we had more people like that in the world.
Do you think Megan is dancing in heaven somewhere?
Oh, I know she is. And, you know, it's tested our faith. And I know she watches over us. You know, there are times when I kind of feel like someone's watching me, you know, and I feel it's her.